I'm just curious to know if anyone has so far today had everything the way they wanted it. If everything has been according to your preference. Someone's nodding, okay. Miracles happen. You just got here. It's kind of a fine line on retreat when we try to sort of minimize disturbance and we come to a place like this, which is pretty much heaven, and the food is so good, and we don't have to sort of deal much with each other. We can start to get into that as an occupation, like getting it how we want it, as an occupation. And it can be like really diminishing of ourselves to start to think that way, like unconsciously think that way. So this unconscious belief that I have to have it easy in order to meditate, or have to have it easy in order to experience what's going on or to discover. But we do want to make it easier, because we've come here for a reason. So I'd like to title this talk, Unfixing Yourself. And from the very beginning, to have it more clear, to just really state it more clearly, that we do want to make it easy for ourselves, and we don't. And that's not like me telling you, you should make it easy for yourself, and you should not make it easy for yourself, but trying to feel deep inside yourself where you don't want to be fixed. So you don't want to be fixed like improved so that then you fit in better. But especially you don't want to be fixated. You don't want to be fixed and in the sense of stuck in one position that might be like perfect or something. The kind of perfection that we call for from deep within is more on the move, more fluid. Like unfixated, unfixable. And so sometimes we feel broken and we do want to be fixed. And we maybe want someone to fix us, or at best teach us how to fix us. And there's not even anything wrong in that. Like, that's not something to fix either. There's nothing wrong in wanting to fix. But if we could delve down into that urge to fix, so what's actually happening? Where is it? Where's the movement towards fix me coming from? Is there some pain, or is there just some kind of wild wonder that has gotten tired, that's tired of being in a cage? Or both. So is there a reason that we want to fix ourselves, or is it a mystery, or both? And then if we could slow down a little bit and just feel the movement towards fixing. One of the main things that puts us in a hurry is the sense, the idea, and then the experience that there could be something wrong with you. So wrong that you're out of here. You can't belong with that wrong. And so you have to kind of hide what's wrong until you get it fixed, and then you can belong. That's the deal that we kind of accepted, basically. We've accepted that deal somehow. That's why there's struggle. And so if we could wipe away the sense of needing to hide anything, Which the same is the same thing to say, wipe away the sense that we have to show anything. Because as soon as we hide something, we have to show something. We project something onto the screen that's covering up. And then we also can't actually find out what's happening. It's not only that we fooled everyone else, which we haven't, but we fooled ourselves. And so to just have the chance to slow down and find out that, especially that particular step in our hurry to fix. That if I smell something might be a little bit wrong with me, then I get into a hurry to cover it up and then try to make it better. And what could be another option? Another approach.
Slow down and let that pop.
Yeah, slowing down. But then the requirement to love that part as a requirement could feel like, again, we're in a straitjacket. I should be loving that. And so if we just slow down again, I wish I could love that. That's one thing that might be there. Or that wishes to be loved is another approach, either way or both. And then if they meet, great. And so then we find that we have less and less work to do. So we would love to love that, or that would love to be loved. All that that needs is to feel love. In fact, when we slow down and let it spread out a little bit, and find that we're all in it together, that we have exactly the same with a different story. So what could be the worthwhile in hiding it when anyway it's visible and anyway we're in it together? We can find we can actually have a discovery of what is needed, having what it needs. So I'd love to read you one of my favorite poems by E.E. Cummings. And it's just in a collection, and it's called Number 30. One winter afternoon. And then he was one of those early poets to experiment with using different punctuation. And so the punctuation is important. And he's that one, if you don't know, he's the one who, long before internet, didn't capitalize. So he didn't capitalize his name. He does capitalize like two words in the poem, which I'll let you know when I get there. One winter afternoon. And then he has in parentheses. So it's a little bit of a feeling of going through a tunnel. One winter afternoon, and then parentheses, at the magical hour when is becomes if. And we're lucky here to have, even though it's not winter, we have that kind of light this afternoon, yesterday afternoon, where we can get a sense of that magical hour when is becomes if. And I think I'll already pause in this passageway. Going into the magical hour. Because it's important in our meditation practice when there's a kind of natural drive to want to know what is and to experience what is. And then there's also the way that we think we should observe, experience, notice what is. And when we have lost touch with the kind of magic and openness of those times that we experience what is, and we let the drive kind of make us closed-minded, and we let the should drive us, instead of the natural impulse or drive, with that a mental should and an emotional should also, tightness and pressure, drive our practice to try to experience what is, then there's a tendency to fix what we're experiencing and to not let it be as it is, which is very, very open and ungraspable, unfixable. We can, if we let our openness be in touch with the openness of experience, how, for example, it's continually changing, whatever we're paying attention to, whatever we're experiencing. It's continually fluid in a way that mentally we can't grasp. But when we let the mental drive take over the practice, then we create a mental version of our experience and hold on to that. And so you've noticed the difference today between a mental footstep and a footstep. A simple, ordinary, real, living footstep with no capital letters, just a footstep or an out-breath. Your version of the mental, not even your, but the mentally created, under pressure created version of, so the anticipated out-breath. And then when there's enough openness to let that actually fall through, they're completely different experiences. But it's so easy to fall for the version and to take that as real. And because it's easier to feel that, because it's less subtle, less alive, it's easier to feel it because we've had more practice feeling mental versions of our life. We're practiced at that. We've trained in that. So that's easier to feel. And so it's easy to stick to that. And then there's hardly any room left for the aliveness, for this aliveness to be in contact with the other aliveness. So when E.E. Cummings said the magical hour, when is becomes if, it could sound like we're going to some imaginary place away from what is, away from direct experience. But as a poet, he's helping us feel how our usual way is unreal. What we call is, what we call real, what we call I think generally we call it real life. And we consider what E.E. Cummings is calling if, which we could also call what if. We consider what isn't fixed as an escape, something that we go away to for a while, maybe to get a little refreshed, to go back to what we call real life. And if only, what if, we would let our experience of the fluidity and open-endedness of our real experience, if we would let that inform us more, we would let there be exchange, we would let that tell us about itself, really. So not tell us about ourselves in about itself in words, but to let it come across us like a wave. We would notice how well even difficult situations get woven into a learning and discovering organic process. Are there any questions or comments so far? In the felt experience of our lives now, We can always just check. Not we have to think about earlier today, how was it, but even now. If we leave room for ourselves to receive the experience, kind of belly up, so that the thinking part of us will be the last to know what's happening or what has happened. And so that's again where there's a sense of slowing down. It actually allows our process and our practice to quicken, because we're not just putting the brake down all the time, like, wait a second, how's it going? How am I doing? We allow ourselves not to know verbally, mentally, for quite a long time, often. And we allow ourselves to know belly up quite immediately. We start to leave room for that immediacy of knowing. And sometimes we notice that that starts to have a response right away without having processed it through our thinking and checking, was that okay? And we can have an experience of a different intelligence moving through that we appreciate, that we didn't create, but we do appreciate it. It's wow. The question comes, is that my intelligence? And we don't hurry to answer because we don't know. We didn't input material and then come up with that clever response. It happened as a flow. Is it not my intelligence? I don't know. And when we let our real experience inform us and flow through our own deeper intelligence, with patience in terms of not actually being able to verbalize what we're doing or what's happening, we start to feel how at home we are with this mystery. Is it my intelligence? Is it not my intelligence? One winter afternoon, at the magical hour when is becomes if, a bespangled clown, so a clown in a sparkling costume, standing on 8th Street, handed me a flower. So that's basically the story of what happened. But then a lot more gets moved. So a bespangled clown standing on 8th Street handed me a flower. Nobody, and that's the first capital word in the poem, nobody, it's safe to say, observed him but myself. And why? Because, without any doubt, he was whatever, first and last, most people fear most. I'll read it again because it's that kind of poem. I wanted you to hear when the rhyming starts to come in. So we've gone through that little tunnel into the magical hour. And nobody, it's safe to say, observed him but myself. And why? Because, without any doubt, he was whatever, first and last, most people fear most. So no one else noticed the clown. That's what didn't happen. So the story is the clown had handed the flower. What didn't happen, what isn't a story, is that no one else saw this happen. And this again is kind of a secret to meditation practice. There are the first layers where we start to feel more free to just enjoy being here on planet Earth, and how lovely it is for there to be a breath and a footstep and contact with the ground. And that it doesn't need to be that I'm walking in a way that someone else would think is really great. or that my breath really goes according to all those confusing pranayama yoga instructions that I've had, which seem contradictory in the heart of them and the experience of them, maybe not. But then there's also this big other layer that is really all the layers. It's nobody, it's safe to say, observed him but myself. So it's also when I'm not observing myself that the flower can be given, that the flower does get given from this unassuming. So it's not that kind of clown. When I first read clown, I was like, oh, I wish it wasn't a clown, because clowns usually are more or less in your face trying to get observed because they have some statement to make, because they're right about something that they know better than anyone else or whatever. That's usual clownness. But then there are these friends that I have that go to clown school, and what they tell me it's about, because I still don't get it, but I ask them, so what do you do? What is it about? Is anyone here a clown in that way? Clown, like the red nose? Apparently what it's all about is vulnerability. And they say that you just put on, one exercise is just put on the red nose and stand up here in front of us. That's all. Apparently having the red nose on in front of us brings out an embarrassment. So also I made a mistake in reading the poem in telling you, because last time I read it someone said, what is bespangled? So I'm telling you bespangled means sparkling. But I said sparkling costume. We don't know. It could just be some other kind of sparkle. The costume word is not in here. So forgive me for adding something that wasn't here. Sometimes all we can do, the best that we can do, and that's where we start, is observe ourselves. And it can be interesting, especially because it tends to bring out the inner critic, as well as the critic that wants to criticize outwardly. The inner critic that wants to blame outside as well as inside. And that's interesting because that's one of the main prisons that we're trained to live inside. And so we can start to notice that and see how it is to live without that. Living without that is probably more or less like living with the red nose on. There's a sense of nakedness or vulnerability. That it is our practice to find out if riding along in that flow is where we belong, is more safe than our usual defenses. I had been wanting to speak about another poem as well. For the last few weeks has been coming to my mind, and just last night someone said the title of the poem, Dark Night of the Soul. The title of the poem has come to mean something else. It's come to mean those times where we feel completely desolate and we just have to keep going somehow. But the actual poem is not that. The actual poem is this: when there's nobody, it's safe to say, observed him but myself. The house has gone dark and quiet in the night, and that's when the flower is given. That's when, in the Dark Night of the Soul poem, the one who loves God, let's say, kind of goes out of the house. It has a feeling of like floating out of the house. So like being free from our usual sense of limitation. So I think it's good to know from the beginning that we may start by feeling, what is this body? And then we might stick to our idea of what is this body. So we have the image of what is this body, and we have the history of what is this body. And we've been taught and trained about what is this body. But often our real experience, in the way that I mean it today, our real experience of this body, just simple physical experience. I'm not talking about out-of-body states, but simple physical experience is not confined to where we see the skin ending or beginning. Just, you know, if you want to feel your hand just now. Is it really sure that what you feel, if you don't look at your hand and get that reference point of the visual, how sure is it in your direct experience now of the hand that the sensation is confined to inside the skin? And if we don't feel like we have to put those two things together, we just let the two, the visual is one thing and the felt experience of the hand is another thing. We start to leave room for another kind of direct experience that's not so much observing. So E.E. Cummings says, why nobody observed him, this clown. Because without any doubt he was whatever, first and last, most people fear most. And so again, I'll probably read the whole thing through at some point, so don't worry. What most people, first and last is again in parentheses, what most people, whatever, first and last, most people fear most. I think we could also extend that sentence honestly to say what we most of the time fear most, first and last. So not just like most people, those people who aren't in the meditation hall, but most of us most of the time, first and last, fear most. And so just to pause in the poem here, to just notice how often and how easily fear drives us in our practice. There's the fear in that hurried way that we want to get it right. And so we already start running. We've got to hurry, like catch up with everybody else or whatever, and catch up with the breath, catch up with that. It's such a flowing experience, we keep trying to catch up. And the thoughts seem to keep interrupting or keep taking over. And that's because they're trained to do that so far. The training can change the flow of the thoughts with time. So fear most, first and last. Noticing if our motive in practice is fear. We're afraid of our pain, we're afraid of this world. It doesn't seem to be an easy place to live. And so we want some place that we could take refuge, some place that we might be safe. Some place or some way that will make things better. So it's important to know where that motive lives in you, when it's active, and what it feels like. It's not important to try to repress that or muffle it and pretend it isn't there. But when that is the motive, it's good to know. And we might want to then turn our gentleness and sensing towards that fear, but without saying, it's okay, it's going to be okay. In some storyline way. In some storyline way, it's not going to be okay. You're not going to get what you want all the time. Even in a place like this on a retreat with good food cooked for you, etc. There may be, there is maybe, some other kind of okayness. But we can get into that okayness when we stop pretending to ourselves and others that it's going to be okay in a storyline way. It may or it may not, and it's not in our hands completely. It's hardly in our hands at all. So that could be called the first fear. To feel for it and leave room for it. Not necessarily let it be the only reason to practice, the only reason to just do nothing. And then as we go along and start to be in touch with real living experience and in its fluidity, we also come up with a very real fear of annihilation. It's similar but different from that first motive. Because in this second case, might not be the last fear, but it's maybe a middle fear, we're actually experiencing annihilation in a certain way. And so it's natural that that fear will come. But it's good to know, like from the beginning, that we're calling forth our natural fear of annihilation. And we can kind of feel like there's a sense of like a boat that could cut across that. It's like the wake of another boat. The boat of wanting freedom can slowly, steadily, surely just ride right across the wake of the boat of, let's say, biological fear. The fear of the limited. The fear that comes from our trained sense that we're this limited, separate individual who's got to make it on our own. And how that ties together with our survival biological instinct. So our deep psychology that was ingrained, that we also kind of accepted. Like, be nice or you're out. Or, if you don't be bad, you won't get attention. Those are two sort of easy ones for you to go and find what yours are. That deep psychology is really interwoven with the survival drive. And so again, it's not to kind of try to blank it out and pretend it isn't operating, but to know it's naturally going to come up when we're in touch with how our real living experience is, which is not fixed, which is not reassuring. It's not like, yes, you're a solid separate self and you're going to keep that container forever. Our real living experience doesn't say that at all. And in a certain way also, we might have hoped that the more we meditate, the easier it will get. We might have hoped. And that would be tied to that fear from the beginning. And it's okay, but it's not going to happen. It's not going to get easier. Certain things will certainly get easier, and certain things will certainly get wider and more of a challenge. And we love it. There's something in a human being that really loves it, that doesn't want to just get stuck in some, now I'm fixed, I'm done. Somewhere we kind of hope for that, but that's this really small place that we couldn't live in. And so if we start to, through doing nothing, and just being here, we start to disentangle these different threads of fear. And we start to soothe and rework and unravel that psychological part. We let it unravel by not freaking out when it takes over or when it gets a bit triggered. So we can just find a place that's a bit wider, and maybe there'll be love. Maybe there'll be love for that, just because it needs love, which is all it needs. When we say it's all it needs that steadiness to just hold a space where love could happen. So it needs those two things, the steadiness that allows there to be space, which is already there, which allows the love to happen which already happens by itself. So then our job is the steadiness part. That's what we can develop. Preferably, we don't develop it by going on a hunt for the difficult and the painful and trying to go into the difficult and the painful. We could rather go on a hunt for where is my deep wish and for what? And rather let that drive our practice. Letting that naturally arisen fear in the face of our real living experience telling us that all these ways that we'd imagined that we were we tried to console ourselves, we'd imagined that we'd gotten good enough at something and therefore we could be okay. Or we'd imagine that we'd gotten needy enough, so therefore we deserved help, and then it's going to be okay. Are all these different imaginings, these delusions. Our real living experience just goes against all of it. It goes against the thought that we couldn't have help. It goes against the thought or belief that we don't have help, that we have to have help or other. It goes against the thought or belief that we have to be good enough and only then, which is to go against the thought that we have to deserve what we are. So our real living experience is showing that we're in full participation in something wider than what we thought we are. And that is not a fixed thing. Sometimes we may need to set up some kind of fixed program for a while as a medicine to go against our habit energy where we're getting taken in by the fear. We might need to put the motor on in that boat that otherwise didn't need a motor. So we don't have to be fixedly into no fixation, no structure. Sometimes structure will arise as really helpful for a while, and then it will dissolve. And it'll be scary when it dissolves. And it'll be okay. Without any doubt, he was whatever, first and last, most people fear most. And then there's a colon, the two dots. Whatever, first and last, most people fear most. A mystery, for which I've no word except alive. And then he has a nice long dash. That is, so alive, that is, completely alert and miraculously whole. So the word alert, it can easily, put our over-alertness into action again. We're into the rhyming section of the poem, and he rhymes alert with heart. Most people fear most a mystery for which I've no word except alive, that is completely alert and miraculously whole, with not merely a mind and a heart, but unquestionably a soul. A fine, not a coarse clown. No mob, but a person, in parentheses again. No mob, but a person. I love that. What we have the chance to discover through deep resting is this completely alert thing. as a discovery instead of something that we put on like a suit and try to be. So resting means, it's so curious to think of what resting is actually. We assume we know what it is, but actually what is resting? Sometimes we lie down and we don't rest. Sometimes we go jogging and we do rest. But mostly we need to lie down a lot more and sleep and do less. To just allow this natural filling up. So we talk about beauty sleep. And what is that but someone is just all rosy and full of life in such a gentle way. So not gentleness as controlled and being kind, giving symbolic gestures of kindness in this transactional way, but just gentleness with a spring in its step. Gentleness that's not necessarily contained by rules. Can even say outrageous gentleness or gentle outrageousness. And we talk about healing sleep. So if someone's feeling not very well, even doctors would say drink a lot and rest a lot so that you don't get sick. But what's actually going on there? Drink a lot and rest a lot. And by the way, when you're resting a lot, it is important